This is your Uncle Don, back after a fortnight's absence with show number 302. You know you're growing old when you can look back and recall incidents in your life that happened a half century ago. I keep being slapped in the face by such memories. For instance, 50 years ago tomorrow, I raised my right hand, becoming a certified recruit, property for all intents and purposes of the United States Army. In retrospect, I found my choice of timing fortuitous. I passed my enlistment during one of those rare three-year periods when the U.S. was not involved in a hot war. That was just one bit of luck in a string forming my trajectory as I ricocheted through life. As the global recession spreads, the North is being hit hard. It's impacting British Columbia enough that Gordon Campbell followed Stephen Harper's example by reneging on a promise to balance our provincial budget. And Campbell's fiscal balance wasn't just a throwaway pledge like Harper's, but an actual law. But law schmaw, politicians do what's expedient. This is not to say I don't agree with a temporary deficit. It's good Keynesian economic policy in a recession. The point is that nothing politicians say, nor law they pass, effectively restrains them. We saw the extreme when that despicable George Bush absolutely refused to enforce laws of the land that he had been sworn to uphold. When Vladimir Putin or Hugo Chavez circumvents a law or custom, our leaders are quick to call them dictatorial. When our boys do it, well, it's necessary for the public good, circumstances have changed, blah, blah, blah. Politicians aren't the only duplicitous buggers in these hard times. Corporations often outdo them, if you can imagine that. Canfor shut down several of its BC mills, allegedly, for 2 weeks. But will they resume operations when this time is up? Might this be an indefinite or even a permanent closure of some of their operations? Why would they lie? I heard that one Prince George Forestry company just last week laid off staff supposedly for a short period. Departing workers were given official records of employment that would be necessary to claim unemployment insurance. They wondered why such documents were necessary if the employer was truthful in saying they would be recalled in a couple of weeks. Since the waiting period for EI is 2 weeks, none would be able to claim anyway. If any company tells its workers that they'll be called back soon, everything will be left intact. Should employees believe they won't return, they just might be tempted to toss a spanner into the works on the way out. It's human nature for discarded workers to be angry and vindictive, just as it's human nature for management to lie to preserve their property. We'll see whether these mills open again next week. Bets anyone? Governments don't always lie. Sometimes their misstatements are merely results of ignorance, stupidity, or plain wishful thinking. Take your pick when it comes to cost estimates for Vancouver Olympic security. When the bids were being assembled, the guy in charge of security looked at his hat band and read size 1 3/4, so he estimated $175 million. How else could he, she, or it have come up with such a ridiculously small figure in light of the $1 billion-plus spent in Salt Lake City and the huge amounts for securing other Olympic venues even before the paranoia following the creation of the World Trade Crater? It looks now like the total to be squandered on police, soldiers, flyboys, and sailors to keep terrorists and, of course, protesters away from the good folks enjoying the huge party will run over $1 billion. Even that figure conceals costs like overtime for those cops left behind to fill vacant shifts and crime related to lax policing away from the games. The deployment of Canadian military in Vancouver Whistler is slated to be larger than that in Afghanistan. Who gains and who loses when the jocks go home, the work is done, and the bills left to be paid? The Battle of the Buses is coming to North America. A campaign by free thinkers in Britain to promote atheism is spreading rapidly and may be coming to a public transportation system near you. These advertisements have a simple theme. There probably is no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy life. The campaign has enough traction that the United Church hired a Toronto ad agency to come up with a series of counter ads with the message, "There probably is a God." So, on which side of this argument does evidence lie? If I declare that a cosmic white rabbit follows an Earth orbit on the far side of the sun, I'd better come up with some evidence or I'll be subject to serious ridicule. If, on the other hand, I hold, without a shred of evidence, that an invisible something constructed and rules the universe, being everywhere in the sky, I'm called religious. I am then held in esteem. look at implications that there probably is no God. Then there are no grounds for believing that we have eternal souls any more than have dogs, cats, or ants. The spark of life disappears like the flame of a blown candle. No soul, no heaven or hell. Then every nasty bastard who lied, cheated, and robbed his neighbor is expiring peacefully in a stolen feather bed is not being eternally punished. And those good people who toiled and suffered for their fellows, dying painful, tragic deaths, are not reclining on clouds. Nor are martyrs inflicted with the eternal attentions of flocks of giggling virgins. Those of the world's upper classes enjoying the fruits of a good life on the backs of the oppressed don't want us to believe that we cease to exist in any form when we die. That implies we'd better seek justice here on earth rather than suffer under their yoke. Although many of the faithful are inspired to perform good deeds, this is not a rule. Jihadists are driven to mass murder in the name of their religion. Christian crusaders slaughtered untold innocents in a sacred quest for holy lands. Israeli Jews relentlessly persecute Palestinians, having the nerve to have lived for generations on land promised to them by a sky god. I worked with a brutal born-again jail guard who told me he could do anything he pleased and he would still spend eternity in heaven as he had accepted Jesus as a savior. His callousness was legendary. I see no indication that belief in gods or eternal life is correlated with goodness. There are certainly good and bad people of all beliefs, or none. Absence of faith might inspire people to seek the ideal of maximizing gross national happiness. This goal moves the king of Bhutan, ruling a land with a majority of Buddhists but with a significant minority of Hindus and Muslims. The quest for larger gross national happiness implies that excess wealth of the few should be spread among the masses to raise the majority out of poverty. From this, it's a short walk to that dreaded socialism. No wonder the establishment promotes religion. Those enthralled to supposed justice in the hereafter are less likely to demand it in the present. Religion has always been a handy weapon in the quiver of the powerful. The influence of faith is not always negative. Christopher Hitchens wrote a popular book in 2007 entitled God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. I haven't read his work, but I can't agree with its title. Here in Prince George, the St. Vincent de Paul Society, run by the Catholic Church, does yeoman's work in feeding and supporting the homeless. Likewise, the Salvation Army, another religious organization. There are many individuals of goodwill working within churches, synagogues, mosques, and whatever. It's curious, however, that this was left to these religious organizations to aid the wretched of Canada when politicians, all of whom profess faith, cannot be bothered in their pandering to corporate wealth. The faithful are often the backbone of efforts toward peace and other good causes, and more power to them, but their works do not validate underlying assumptions of supernatural powers. In the UNBC library, you can find a scholarly work by Michael Persinger entitled Neurological Bases of God Beliefs. This faculty member of Sudbury's Laurentian University discovered that electrical stimulation of certain portions of the brain can stimulate experiences similar to those reported by deeply religious. Could it be that Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus was due not to divine intervention, but by a misfiring of synapses? That seems every bit as probable as the God thesis. A recent Globe article by Sarah Jewell, referred to as a contributor to the United Church Observer, has her own reason for believing in God. It was her God in the form of a next-door neighbor arranging a blind date who paired her with her second husband, now her soulmate. Does this love validate faith? I met my soulmate in jail due to a fortuitous scheduling of shifts, but I don't credit this to a God. It was a human choice for which I am grateful, but I can't see signs of a heavenly miracle. Those who choose to hold religious beliefs have many and varied reasons for their faith, but it can usually be traced to doctrines inflicted upon them in their formative years. The correlation between faiths of parents and those of their offspring is more than coincidental. Parents are often fearful the exposure of their kids to other beliefs, or none, will corrupt them. They take great efforts to avoid this. This is seen in Canada by the way some parents fight tooth and nail against having their children attend classes in comparative religions. If guardians are blessed with any of the world's many and exclusive true faiths, What have they to fear from their kids learning of other obviously inferior beliefs? Governments are mandating increased fuel efficiency, recognizing that today's lower prices and availability are a passing phase. Soon enough, the world economy promises to recover, demand will increase, and energy prices may rise to unprecedented levels. Now is the time to follow through with programs promoting smaller, less thirsty cars, better home insulation, and more. So what the hell is behind Harper's inclusion in his stimulus package of $25 million for upgrading trails, not for horses, bicycles, or hikers, but for snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles? These vehicles have their place on farms and as transport in remote areas, but are pure waste when used to ride in circles on government-financed trails. In our rural area, we have these motorized clowns as well as trail motorcycles running up and down our roads in spite of laws prohibiting unlicensed and uninsured vehicles. What thrill do these people get from obstructing traffic and invading private properties? On some future day, it's certain that economics will coincide with environmental necessity, and these machines will go the way of auto racing and being banned. The sooner the better, and we should not be using public money to subsidize this foolishness. While the feds squander borrowed money on racetracks, they haven't the gumption to settle old debts. 10 years ago, they agreed to pay a combined $3.2 billion to some 230,000 current and past employees in a settlement of a pay equity dispute, one that has been in progress for 15 years. They still refuse to fund this acknowledged obligation. Any good reasons why they couldn't now cough up this money instead of giving it to corporations? Does it have anything to do with the willingness of companies to support conservatives, whereas those 250,000 individuals might not? Will companies use gifted funds to stimulate the economy or to fatten executives and stockholders? For sure, most of that money due to individuals who earned it, the ones still alive, would be spent on such frivolities as food, clothing, and shelter. Want to know what the bailout is all about? Follow the money. Not all corporations are in need of a rescue. Some have even increased their CEO bonuses. In 2007, Lockheed Martin's chief executive, Robert Stevens, received a salary of $1.63 million and a bonus of $3.9 million. 2008's salary is frozen, but his bonus target is increased. Gee, how can Lockheed buck the trend of corporate losses in these rough times? It helps that the corporation has one main customer, the United States government, a lavish spender, and one main product, weapons systems. Last year, total sales were over $42 billion, on which it registered a profit of $3.22 billion. This, coincidentally, was a period when George Wanker Bush was increasing military purchases. Just when the U.S. declares that terrorists are the greatest threat to peace, Lockheed has been chosen as the major contractor for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft program. That's what it takes to counter suicide bombers and planters of roadside explosives, a new supersonic jet aircraft. The cost of this boondoggle is estimated to be a mere $300 billion, but we know what these estimates are worth. Figure half a trillion minimum, and lots of that will stick to the fingers of Lockheed Martin. The United States, followed dutifully by a lickspittle Canadian administration, intends to violate international law by attacking criminals in Afghanistan. Occupation armies are not supposed to engage in police actions. This is to be left to local forces. However, North American politicians have come up with a rationalization for going after what they call drug lords engaged in the opium trade, supplying some 90% of the world's illicit heroin. Their profits, it is alleged, provide funds to the dreaded Taliban. This move is desperate and illegal, stupid and downright dangerous. Opium growing, transportation, and processing are the backbone of what passes for an economy in Afghanistan. Attacks on the so-called drug lords hold the potential of going up the production line from small farmers, but not as far as the big pushers who move the drugs to our continent. These guys are connected. I read that the idea of buying opium directly from farmers to cut out drug lords is not practical. And why not? Because the price for legal opium is lower than the illicit trade. This is bullshit. our buyers could pay double the world underworld price, and it would be far cheaper than the billions we spend on our current war. One suspects that there are those in our governments who want to perpetuate this international trade in opium and its derivative heroin. Follow the money. This is CFUR at 88.7 in Prince George. Prince George's property taxes will most likely rise by a whole 3.4%. Oh, woe is us, the beleaguered taxpayers of our fair city. I brace for an onslaught of public anguish in the press and on air. City Council will be cursed around the tables of Tim Hortons. Well, we collectively ask for it. The majority of our citizens voted for a conservative federal government, one pledged to cut taxes. This they did, and in the process downloaded a goodly amount of their fiscal burden onto the provinces. The majority of our citizens voted for a liberal provincial government, one pledged to cut taxes. This they did partly by downloading a number of responsibilities onto municipalities. This is why it's up to our city to pay for, among other of Victoria's former responsibilities, the Cameron Street Bridge replacement and upkeep of provincial highway margins within city limits. It remains to the city to maintain the communal sandbox after the federal and provincial cats are through with it. Even with a modest increase in property taxes, we citizens of Prince George have a bargain. We've good snow clearing, an excellent library system, adequate policing, leisure services, and a host of other amenities that make living in our town worthwhile. We have excellent water, sewer, and firefighting services. Compared with the many other places I've lived, all in all, Prince George is tops. I don't find my taxes an onerous burden. If we want to reduce local taxes, we have to move costs back up the ladder to levels where they've been chopped and, incidentally, where the big money is. If we choose to maintain a civilized standard of public services, we have to pay for them, and there is no reason why those who benefit the most cannot pay the most in taxes. I understand the appeal of gambling when it's a test of ability or knowledge. Serious poker is a game of skill more than chance. Betting on a race may be based on experience with horses, dogs, cars, or drivers. But roulette, slots, or lotteries? They make no sense since everyone knows the odds are against the buyer. When you pick up a charity's 50-50 ticket, you know the house takes half, but you're making a gift to a cause. Buying a lottery ticket used to be a backhanded way of supporting local charities and amateur sports. No more, since governments have found these a cash cow to offset progressive taxes. Let the poor carry public expenses as they dream of instant riches. There was a survey done a couple of years back in which Canadians were asked about their retirement plans. About 10% mentioned hoped-for lottery winnings as part of their planning. It was embarrassing that British Columbian citizens were more likely than others to factor in fantasized gambling prizes. But go down to your corner gambling kiosk, casino, or gin mill with its television bingo and put your money down. If you bet a lot of money, you'll probably win some of it back. Just enough to keep you hooked while the parasites take their cut. As you go for the big win on a lottery, figure you're more likely to be killed driving to the ticket peddler than to win a prize. In all forms of institutionalized gambling, your bets pay for printing, advertising, salaries, telephone lines, gambling machines, overhead, and rent. It's a wonder there's any money left for prizes at all. What is really amazing is that lottery ticket sales have increased as our economy tanks. When jobs are precarious and savings disappear, we'd expect rational people to be watching their money and not blowing it. But by a quirk of human psychology, people will lay down that last buck on a long shot. I've been to Las Vegas several times. It's a great place for people watching, and the odds offered by their casinos are better than a lottery. I actually came out ahead as I found a nickel on the floor of one joint. I'm reminded the story told me by a customer when I worked in California. He told of a friend who drove to Reno to gamble. He went there in a $30,000 car and returned in a $500,000 Greyhound. I'm not alone in harboring deep misgivings about all of the stimulus being pumped into the economy by governments around the world. More and more politicians, economists, and various pundits are questioning the trillions being spilled into all manner of plans. We're into uncharted territory, throwing money hither and yon, hoping that it will revive a world economy slipping down the pan. Conventional wisdom holds that it was such a stimulus on a smaller scale, pulling the United States out of the Great Depression. But was it? We know that Roosevelt's Works Projects Administration put in a lot of idle people to work, preventing widespread starvation, and built some worthwhile things, but did it break the back of the Depression? Today's packages of spending are not putting shovels in the ground, as so often claimed. Infrastructure projects no longer hire masses of laborers, nor do they come on stream quickly. Lots of planning has to be done, and when they are ready, they employ mostly skilled labor, not necessarily corresponding to the abilities of those unemployed. Sure, we need more public transport, waterworks, sewers, roads, and bridges after decades of neglect, but we don't know that spending on them will restore the flow of money. We're suffering the results of a surfeit of spending of imaginary money, borrowed foolishly and lent lavishly. Why do we now believe that covering bad private loans with bad public money will restore the status quo ante? As money is shoveled at banks and over-leveraged corporations, where is it going? There's hand-wringing as major banks, which benefit from public beneficence, sit on funds provided, pay dividends or bonuses to executives. Billions are going to auto companies that failed to fund retirement obligations while producing cars that few want. A growing number of economists suggest that corporations should not be rescued from their follies by governments. Better to let the bad ones fail while using our money to support individual human victims. By extending unemployment benefits to those in need, the money will flow not to where politicians want it to go, but toward people's needs and desires. There will still be automobiles, but the ones in the future will be the ones that serve public needs. Poorly run corporations will go broke, as would banks run by the impetuous and foolish. But there would always be banks and corporations. The shock of allowing the failing to collapse would be momentous, but with individuals supported through it all, we might come through in better shape than by carrying dinosaur corporations. It might even cost governments less. There's another beneficial effect to be felt by allowing markets to sink losers. In the future, companies would be much more careful about running on debt, leveraging themselves into positions of vulnerability. As it is, we're laying a foundation for moral hazard, especially in organizations deemed too large to fail. When they know that they will be bailed out in any eventuality, they're more likely to take inordinate risks. I certainly don't have definitive remedies for our current slide, but I know enough to realize that the self-proclaimed experts don't either. Here's another aspect of the bailouts that will have unknown consequences. Governments everywhere are financing deficit spending by either printing money or, more commonly, selling bonds. Those bonds are bought by overseas investors, largely China and Japan, or domestically. As for domestic investors, money they put into government bonds is then not available for business or personal spending. So, is the sale of this debt really a stimulus, or does it just promote one kind of expenditure by squeezing another? When money is borrowed overseas, it puts foreign hands on the public steering wheel. Suppose we displease the Chinese government and they decide to dump bonds issued by the U.S. or Canada. We would have to either print bales of money to pay off those bonds by issuing by issuing replacement bonds to others. If there were a reluctance to purchase them, we would have to raise interest rates to sweeten the deal. But if interest rates rose, then the value of outstanding bonds with lower interest rates would decline, angering existing investors. Uh-oh. They might want to sell out too, causing a run on government obligations. So how would one stem a run? By paying higher interest. But look at the United States debt right now. George Wanker Bush left the country with $10 trillion in public debt. Before this alleged rescue is over, that may double. The U.S. has $10 trillion in debt outstanding. So if government bonds pay interest of 5%, that means an outlay of $500 billion a year, and that's without retiring any of it. If the market's reluctant to buy those 5% bonds, maybe 10% would entice them. But then the interest would be a full $1 trillion a year, or $3,000 a year for each man, woman, and child in the United States. Would the tax system be able to pull in that much on top of what is needed to keep government and a bloated military afloat? There's another way out, and I dread that. It would be to allow inflation to grow, thus making it easier to pay down debt with less valuable dollars. It worked in Zimbabwe, but look at the mess it left. Do we really want to see that happen here? Could we prevent it? George Orwell, here we are. You figured on 1984, but you were just a quarter century too early in your predictions. You thought it would be we would be under total surveillance before now, and you had only the date wrong. At one time, long before September of 2001, there was an assumption that our communications were no one's business but our own. Unless governments had sound reasons for violating the sanctity of our lives, we were to be left alone. The bulk of our supposedly private lives are now open books for anyone with a sophistication and interest to probe them. In large part, we're complicit in exposing ourselves to intimate snooping. We blithely use debt, credit, and affinity cards, leaving a detailed history of our lives as consumers. In our every banking transaction is recorded, as are the numbers of our telephone calls. If we travel outside the country, a record is made of where we go, how we spend, and where we stay. Now a new dimension is being added to the trail we leave. Our government, the one professing to be conservative and respecting the rights of individuals, is preparing some new legislation to affect us all. It will require internet service providers to allow police monitoring of emails. The argument of our Orwellian-named Minister of Public Safety, Peter Van Loan, says law enforcement needs to tap our emails and internet use in order to intrude against criminals, where time is of the essence. I remain unconvinced of an overriding need to prepare a mechanism whereby my personal messages can be monitored. Yeah, we hear people say, I don't care, I have nothing to hide. As for me, I don't think I do either, but I'll be damned if I feel that there's such a clear and present danger to our safety and order that I must lay my personal communications open to snooping. Sure, they say that court orders will be necessary, but I just plain don't trust some of the people I know would have access to the fruits of such intrusions. If the means exist to pry further into our business, they will be used for political purposes eventually. One protection we supposedly enjoy in a democracy is a right to dissent and to organize. When we give tools of intrusion to potential abusers, we negate a right to dissent without interference. I mentioned before that in the 80s, a number of us met in Prince George to form a local peace group. At our initial meeting, a clumsy attempt was made to infiltrate our membership. Two young crew-cut men in shiny black shoes appeared asking questions and seeking names. We quickly identified and ostracized them, but were they just cover for other official plants? We never knew, nor will we ever. We need the freedom to organize and communicate without having Big Brother monitor us. When we lose that, we surrender a precious means to resist totalitarianism. This closes the 302nd Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Good riddance, eh?